On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA.
You know, I grew up in a very rural environment. I felt like an outcast. There was no one else around like me. And now I pretty much live like this 24/7. There are Leathermen out there in square landlocked states that would kill to experience my life for 10 minutes.
The family of Leathermen at Tom House in Echo Park coming up. And why has housing become a ballot box battleground? Before we get to that, though, in the 2016 presidential campaign, we have been hearing a lot about the loss of manufacturing in America and the loss of dignity for many that has been the result.
We're losing our jobs. We're losing our factories. They're going to China. They're going to Mexico.
Bring millions of manufacturing jobs back to this country. Bring the steel industry back to this country.
We're also hearing about the need to ensure people are skilled in new high-tech manufacturing jobs.
We are going to rebuild our manufacturing base. Yes. Corporate America is going to invest in this country, not just in China.
It's why we should provide incentives for companies that invest in high-quality training for employees, which can lead to higher-paying jobs.
But what are those jobs and are there enough of them? Because while factories have been coming back to the US and productivity is reportedly up 20%, manufacturing employment is up just 5%, and that's because of high levels of automation. There are still jobs that need the human hand, however. And over the coming weeks, we're going to air a series called Modern Trades. It's going to look at the jobs in fabrication and construction, where new technology meets traditional skills. And we'll ask, how are Americans being prepared for these jobs? To kick us off, we turn to Kelly Kandel. He's a writer and filmmaker who served four terms as a trustee of the LA Community College District. He spent many months capturing the stories of the construction workers at the 73-story high Wilshire Grand Center in downtown LA.
These buildings, of course, don't get built by themselves. You know, hundreds and hundreds of workers have to do this work to put that building up. And so the theme of it is, you know, how do you connect the brain and the hand in these skilled trades in such a way that the work that you do is up to the standards that are required of that work? And where does that knowledge come from that connects the hand and the brain? Where do you learn it? You know, how is it passed on? You know, how does a journeyman pass on knowledge to an apprentice, for instance? And it's something that's been lost, I think, in our culture, certainly in our schools, where many of our public schools have gone away from teaching these trades and these crafts. And I think it's been a national tragedy to have moved in a direction where a lot of people simply think that these skilled trades are not worthy of choosing.
And there's also a good economic reason for going into some of these jobs.
Yeah, certainly on the union side, you can earn as a journeyman up to $60 an hour, and you can support a family. You can send your kids to school. You have health benefits. You have a pension, which is disappearing from our economy, obviously. Less and less people have pensions when they retire. But there's a lot of pride in these trades. They honor themselves and their brothers and sisters who work next to them. And they're very often overlooked.
Tell us one of the stories that particularly stood out in this regard.
Well, there's an iron worker named Seffi Ettery that I met out there on the site. He is what they call a rod buster. They put in the iron rebar that provides the shell for the concrete that is poured inside that rebar, thereby stabilizing the building. And as I got to know him a little bit, I went to his home and I found out that he was also a painter. You know, he paints these beautiful paintings that he, you know, brings to the worksite, and he sold some of them to his fellow workmates. It was just fascinating the way he talked about the way his painting and the way what he does at work kind of coincide. He sees the rebar as a kind of patterns that are really fascinating to him, like the pattern of muscle tensile or the pattern of a shirt. And this is artistic thinking.
The way I see it is being a rod buster and an iron worker, it's very physical and you really have to have a lot of heart doing it, you know, because you're always walking on uneven terrain. You have to lift a large amount of weight. When it's all done, you know, like the hotels are built, the buildings built. Nobody really remembers the guys who, you know, really broke their back to do it. So we kind of just go in there and do it like warriors. I feel like we all are. And a lot of them were surprised. Wow, Seth, you're an artist. You paint. You know, why are you doing this? Why are you an iron worker? Why don't you stick to your art? And I just, you know, I love both worlds, though.
So it just exploded this whole myth, this cliche that construction workers somehow might be limited in their thinking. And I just found so many stories like that of people who were so bright and so intelligent and took those skills and their creativity and apply it to this work. They're all over the place.
But this fellow who's laying the rebar, for example, where did he get his trade?
Well, he learned it in a school, in an apprenticeship school. You know, all of the unions have 4 and 5 year apprenticeship programs where they're very rigorous. You know, they're not just teaching hand knowledge, which of course is very important, how to put things together, how to utilize rebar, how to carry, but also how to read blueprints or, you know, the physics of, you know, how a crane operates. And those programs last for 4 and 5 years. When you come out, you're a journeyman. One of the interesting philosophical themes that I was looking into was the notion of tacit knowledge. And that is knowledge that we know, but we don't have the ability to tell. It's hand knowledge. It's body knowledge. It's implicit knowledge. So you can't read it in a book. You can't write it. You can't really write and tell someone how to drive a car, but you know how to do it from experience and learning. So I was fascinated by that. It's an idea from Michael Polanyi, a philosopher, about tacit knowledge, and he thinks it's part of most of the knowledge that we gain as human beings, that it's a disaster to ignore it because it's so important in most of the work that we do.
But a lot of these trades, as you yourself have discovered and written about these days, require knowledge of, say, computing, which is not tacit knowledge. Are the trades these days a kind of mixing of tacit hand-eye knowledge coupled with school knowledge?
Exactly. I mean, it's fascinating just the new tools that people are using on these job sites. I mean, there are, you know, people that are running caterpillars or backhoes that are able to look into the glasses that they wear, these kind of semi-goggles, and see blueprints in those goggles of what they are digging up. In other words, the blueprints are right in front of them that they can see, and it's projected onto the ground that they are working on. Same thing with these Trimble machines that plumbers use that tell you by GPS through a machine that you're utilizing out in the field, where exactly the hole should go for the sleeves or the pipe that they're putting into a ceiling or a floor. So it's just fascinating, the technology, how information is delivered to the workers out in the workplace. The ability to utilize this technology and understand this technology is really crucial.
Do you think the jobs are out there for people to take, but maybe there needs to be some more education about what these jobs are? And do you think the paths are there to get to these jobs?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In fact, LA Unified School District right now is working with the building trades on a core curriculum program that they're offering to all juniors and seniors, offering it to them. You don't have to take it. It's an elective, but it's 120 hours where they can, if they take these classes, learn about all of these trades. You know, it might be for people who say, you know what, I don't want to go to college at this time, but I want to have a good career. I don't want to work in McDonald's. You know, I want to have something where I can have a future and take care of a family. That's happening at LA Unified, and that's very, very important because, as you know, all of those vocational programs were stripped away.
We used to call it.
Yeah, we used to have shop class. I took shop class.
Right.
You know, or, you know, there were options like shop class and automobile repair and all that kind of stuff. So, but the shop classes were kind of stripped away. I mean, obviously, they might be more costly, so, you know, we understand that. But given this option that not everyone is going to go to college, not everyone wants to go to college, or they might want to delay college, but they want to have a good career, you know, this is going to be very helpful. The great thing about these union apprenticeship programs is that the workers who are going through them, you know, the apprentices who are going through them for 5 years don't pay anything. They are free for the worker themselves. So they don't come out of those apprenticeship programs with $50,000 or $60,000 of debt. They come out with skills and a job.
That was Kelly Kandel. He's currently at work on a documentary about the building of the Wilshire Grand Centre. It's called Heads, Hands and Hearts, Craftsmanship at Work. And you can see some of his videos at kcrw.com/dnablog. Now, are you in a modern trade? If so, we'd love to hear from you. Write us at dna@kcrw.org. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up after this break, an initiative to slow construction has been postponed, but now there's a new initiative effort aimed at stimulating residential construction. But developers aren't happy about it. Why not? And Robert Mapplethorpe has gone mainstream. But what about the other artist who celebrated hot men in leather? We'll visit the butch hippie community at Tom House.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. In a moment, a visit to Tom House and its family of leather men. Before that, though, a couple weeks back, DNA explored the Neighbourhood Integrity Initiative. That's an effort to get a measure on the ballot that would put a halt to large residential projects made possible by getting variances from the general and community plans. The lightning rod for this movement was the Palladium Residences, a residential complex around a renovated Hollywood Palladium whose developers required a planning amendment so it could incorporate two 30-storey towers. Well, last week, the City Council approved this project. Supporters praised it for helping alleviate LA's housing shortage. And meanwhile, the group fighting to get the Neighbourhood Integrity Initiative on the November ballot announced they were postponing till next March. But now, to add to the initiative confusion, there's another one. DNA producer Avishai Artsy joins me with the story. Hi, Avishai.
Hi, Frances.
Okay, so we've been talking about the Neighbourhood Integrity Initiative. Now we're talking about the Build Better LA Initiative. What is this?
So this is a newer initiative that was introduced last month. And just this past weekend, they began the signature gathering process. It's a measure backed by unions, community groups, and housing advocates. And what's different about this initiative is it would require any developers that want a waiver for height or density limits under current planning rules to include affordable housing, that's one part of it, and hire local workers.
Is this initiative, this Build Better LA initiative, is this somehow a reaction to the Neighbourhood Integrity Initiative?
So what they're saying is it's not a response, but Rusty Hicks, the head of the LA County Federation of Labor, told me that there's been a conversation about housing and affordability that's been going on in LA for a long time.
But when the Neighbourhood Integrity Initiative came forward, it kind of sped up the conversation, maybe spurred action. But our initiative really wasn't a response to the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative. We just felt it was important to put forward a proposal that said this is what we stand for, not what we're against, solely what we're against. We don't believe stopping development in the city for 2 years while you go through a process of good planning is the way to go. We believe that we need housing and we need housing today, and that's what our initiative does.
So on the face of it, this is an initiative that people that want to see more construction of housing should like. And yet, developers are negative about this new initiative. Why do you think that might be?
Well, what developers are saying is that they don't want any more restrictions on their ability to build in LA. You know, we talked to one developer for the episode that we did about the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative, and he called this initiative, the Build Better LA Initiative, a thinly disguised effort to require housing developers to use union labor, which will increase housing costs by 15 to 20% and put non-union contractors out of business. So he's referring to the labor part of the Build Better LA Initiative, which would require that 30% of the work be done by LA residents, 10% of those workers should come from disadvantaged communities. That could mean that they're a veteran, they're homeless, a single parent, have no high school degree, be previously incarcerated, things like that. And that 60% of the workers be graduates of a joint labor management apprenticeship training program. That's what you heard Kelly Kandel talking about in the previous segment. Or have equivalent experience. So not necessarily union members, but it's heavily in favor of people who've gone through this union apprenticeship program.
Okay, so developers, or at least the ones that we're hearing from, don't like this initiative. They also don't like the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative, but the folks with the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative don't like this initiative, even though they have postponed their initiative and they've slightly amended their initiative to allow for affordable housing.
So the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative is calling this Build Better LA Initiative a wolf in sheep's clothing. Because what they're saying is that there are all these loopholes that developers can use to get out of the affordable housing requirements. For example, in the Build Better LA Initiative, the city council can vote by a majority vote to adjust, as in reduce, the developer's promised affordable housing units if the politicians decide that the developer can't make a, quote, reasonable return on investment. Also, the affordable units don't have to be in the same building. They can be up to 3 miles away from the proposed site. So the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative is basically saying that the system is broken, that city council members are getting paid off by developers to allow for these zoning variances, and that they're saying the Build Better LA Initiative would do nothing to stop the soft corruption, as they're calling it, at City Hall.
At the end of the day, does any of this produce more affordable housing?
Well, the Build Better LA Initiative is saying that their proposal is the one that would build more affordable housing as opposed to putting the brakes on development in the city. One of the groups that's backing Build Better LA is the Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing. That's a group that represents affordable housing developers. And they say that this is desperately needed because they lost so much money when the redevelopment agencies went away a few years ago, about $250 million a year. So they say, at least with this plan, things would get built. And that's what we need, is more housing.
But developers will say, just make it easier on us. Don't give us heaps of restrictions. Just let us build, because it's simply by building more residential units that one creates more housing. Well, Avishai, thank you so much for unpacking all of this.
Sure, anytime.
Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. Now to a house that is far more than just a building. It's a community of men in an LA subculture.
Hello, I am Mark Ransdell Bellinger, curator and head of community development for the Tom Findlay Foundation.
Mark Ransdell Bellinger is showing us his bedroom in Tom House. Now, from outside, this is a regular craftsman house on a quiet street in Echo Park, but its tall hedge conceals an unusual interior. The house is a foundation for Tom of Finland, the Finnish illustrator who made homoerotic illustrations of men, mostly having fun with other men while wearing elaborate leather outfits. Tom of Finland himself lived in the house, and now it's seeking cultural landmark status. Ransdell Bellinger explains how it was founded by Dirk Dana in 1984. He was a former model and a Tom of Finland fan who convinced Tom to come to L.A.
Well, the very first Tom of Finland drawing I ever saw was actually a drawing of Dirk. And it's kind of when I realized I was not the only person on Earth attracted to this stuff. There was at least one other person. At that point in time, I was an 11-year-old kid living in Kentucky, and now I'm here living in the house. That drawing hangs 20 feet away from my bedroom. You know, I grew up in a very rural environment. I felt like an outcast. There was no one else around like me. And now I pretty much live like this 24/7. There are Leathermen out there in square landlocked states that would kill to experience my life for 10 minutes. I'm absolutely blessed.
Tell us what you're wearing.
I often joke that it is a very butch Oscar gown. Langlet's jacket, custom-made pants, Daner boots, custom-made shirt, literally probably about 15 grand worth of leather.
And a peaked cap that somehow evokes, frankly, the village people. You know, it evokes a uniformed person. It could be a cop, it could be a firefighter.
Yes, well, Tom was very influenced by the uniform culture, especially coming from World War II. He fought in the war. He saw the Russians. He saw the Germans. He found the uniforms very exciting, as did several men. They came back from the war, landed here in Los Angeles and New York, and that's kind of where the leather cultures began.
And then, of course, you have a rather sculpted beard. Mm-hmm. That's part of the look.
Yes, at the moment I have sort of a rather cut beard and a probably 6-inch mohawk, but I have it covered with the hat right now.
But and you're a really gentle guy, which kind of is at odds with the militaristic thing.
I'm not gentle in the bedroom.
And that's the other point about all the imagery here. There is the S&M kind of imagery going on.
Absolutely. The foundation, the house, is a place for men to come and be men without shame. That's absolutely what Tom's work was about. You look at the drawings, they're happening, most of them outside. They're happening out in the daylight. These guys are enjoying what they're doing. Everyone has a smile on their face. There's a sense of humor to it. And that's coming from a time when these drawings were being done in the 1950s, 1960s, which is absolutely revolutionary for that period in time.
You are currently looking for a cultural historic landmark.
Yes.
Why?
Well, the facility has been here for 30 years. Our history is very important. We want to ensure that it is here for the next generation. We're not just a house. We are an institution. We have artists in residence. We're always working on books, museum exhibitions. I refer to us as the world's largest homoerotic archive next to the Vatican.
The community that coalesced here 30 years ago was obviously, at least judging by the photographs and the drawings, in the early spring of youth, you know, very, very virile men. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about is these men get older.
Yes, we do. Men get older, but the one thing about the leather community is it tends to be a little more accepting of the older generation than sort of the West Hollywood culture. We have sort of a system of, I guess, a paternal relationship. We learn from our older men. We respect them. They were here long before us. Unfortunately, there is kind of a missing generation out there due to AIDS. And I'm of the generation that came up without that generation. And it's not like the West Hollywood culture when, you know, you hit 30 in dog years, you're dead. You will tonight see, you know, gorgeous men here in their 40s, 50s, 60s, even their 70s.
But it's family.
Yes, absolutely correct. Fathers, sons, it is a true family.
That's Mark Ransdell-Bellinger, curator who lives in Tom House. Now, Tom of Finland died in his native country in 1991, but the community that grew around his work inspired many, including architectural writer Mayor Russ and creative director Michael Reynolds. Together with photographer Martin Thompson, they have published a new book, Tom House, Tom of Finland in Los Angeles. It's a celebration of the art and of the household, which Mayor Russ describes as a, quote, butch hippie community. We sat in Tom's former bedroom come studio on a coverlet adorned with Tom's imagery, and we talked about what the house signifies. First up, Mayor Russ.
This is, you know, one of the most interesting pieces of gay cultural history that still sort of exists in a way that evokes its 1970s, 1980s heritage.
This house, as it lives today, is really the legacy of Tom. And it was the message of his work. It was about flying your freak flag, no judgment, being playful with your sexuality, whatever that might be. You know, be it gay, lesbian, straight, trans, bisexual, all of the above. It really was about liberating the individual, I think, sexually through this imagery is something that he really promoted. And if you really study his imagery, it's always very warm, it's very loving, it's very playful, and it's very fun. He really was this beacon of light in the lives of a lot of gay men who were getting this material underground in a lot of ways. And it was, I think it was a very healing, powerful thing that he was doing at the time when homosexuality was illegal.
Well, fast forward to now, there's been huge freedoms have been accomplished. We're now in gay marriage and so on. And yet you, Mayor, quote Volker Morlock, who's a Tom of Finland collector, and he describes the house as the last fortress of Bohemia in a gay cultural landscape that wants desperately to be boring and well-adjusted. Tell me about that, because is that the paradox of these freedoms, is that something's been lost?
Absolutely. And I think it should be, you know, sort of required reading, required visiting for young gays to come to this house and understand what life was like before gay marriage, when this imagery was incredibly radical. You know, there are a lot of gay men who like to separate their professional lives from their personal lives. And, you know, it can be very chintz by day and chaps by night. The message of Tom House is to, you know, wear your leather proudly 24/7. It's, as you say, weddings in the New York Times and party planners and, you know, white Yoji Yamamoto suits on the beach barefoot. This house is a nice tonic to that back when it was more underground, more raunchy, and you felt like you were in something together with a group of people.
I guess I first got an inroad into the gay community in LA through art, through seeing David Hockney's paintings. I guess the two are in some ways contemporaries. Tom is also in LA and he's also capturing gay LA. Tell me about where Tom does stand in the kind of art historical and the depiction of gay life.
Well, I mean, first there's simply the technical excellence. I mean, his facility with the brush and the pencil is incredible. And, you know, it is not far-fetched to say that, you know, there's an old masterly technique at work in his drawings. But you have to place his work, if you're looking to place it in the spectrum of 20th century art history, you have to place it more in a lineage that extends back to, you know, Daumier and Goya and people who looked around at their world and made these drawings that had real political power.
It is spreading, and I think, and the audience is growing incredibly, I think. And, you know, there are two Mapplethorpe shows at LACMA and Getty, and they borrowed a few pieces from the house for the Mapplethorpe shows. You know, Tom and Robert knew one another, and there was definitely cross-pollination there. And a lot of this is all coming up now. I mean, it's the zeitgeist of the moment right now.
That was Michael Reynolds, creative director and U.S. editor of Wallpaper Magazine, and Mayor Russ, West Coast editor of Architectural Digest, talking about their new book, Tom House, Tom of Finland in Los Angeles. And if leather men are your thing, it so happens this is Los Angeles Leather Pride Week. More details online. You've been listening to DNA. The show's producer is Avishai Artsy. It was mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNAblog and follow us on our Facebook page at kcrwdna. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.